shove her overboard." The order came from somewhere near the captain's door, sharp and cold above the roaring wind, and the crew moved without hesitation. The rope tore through Miss Beatrix Lorne's hands as two sailors dragged her across the wet deck, while the sea rose black and violent beyond the rail. With whatever strength she had left, she twisted sideways and pressed a sealed letter into the narrow gap between two wooden barrels. It was the only thing she could still do, the only thing that mattered now. Then they pulled her away from it. "Please," she cried, digging her fingers into the wood. "There is a letter in my pocket. It must reach the Duke of Wycliffe." No one stopped. A man she had once called Uncle stood beneath the lantern near the captain's door, his face turned away as though he could not bear to watch. Yet it was his seal that had ordered the crew to put her in the small boat with no oars, no food, and no hope of reaching land. Beatrix was pushed into the vessel just as a wave struck its side. Her shoulder hit the bench hard, and the world tilted around her. Then from above, the wind caught something. The letter she had pressed between the barrels flew loose across the rain, struck the polished boot of a tall gentleman who had stepped from the shadows and rested against his hand. Duke Ambrose Harrowby looked down at the broken seal, then at the young woman being cast away into the open sea. His expression changed when he read the first line. "If this letter has found you, Your Grace, then the woman they have abandoned is not the criminal they claim she is. She is the only witness to the night your brother died. Would you have cut the rope to save her, even if the truth could destroy your own family? Tell me in the comments, and tell us which beautiful part of the world you are watching from today. If this secret has already pulled you into the storm, subscribe, because the Duke didn't yet know that saving Beatrix would cost him everything he believed about his name." And as the small boat vanished between the waves, Duke Ambrose Harrowby seized the rail and gave the order that would change both their lives forever. Duke Ambrose Harrowby did not consider himself a man who acted on impulse. He had spent 15 years building a reputation for cold judgment, careful silence, and the kind of measured authority that made other men nervous in his presence. He did not raise his voice, he did not make decisions without evidence, and he certainly did not interfere in matters that happened aboard merchant vessels at midnight on the open sea. Yet, here he stood, gripping a rain-soaked letter that had landed against his boot like something thrown by the hand of God, watching a small wooden boat disappear between waves so large they blocked out the horizon entirely. He read the letter again. The handwriting was hurried, but controlled, under extreme fear. "If this letter has found you, Your Grace, then the woman they have abandoned is not the criminal they claim she is. She is the only witness to the night your brother died. She saw who gave the order. She heard the name. She has carried this secret for 3 years because the man responsible told her that speaking would end her life. Tonight, she understands that her silence has not protected her at all." Ambrose folded the letter slowly. His brother Frederick had died 3 years ago. Everyone called it a riding accident. The horse had returned without him. The body had been found in a ditch near the eastern estate boundary, and the coroner had signed the report without hesitation. There had been grief, a funeral, and then the quiet, suffocating process of moving forward that aristocratic families performed so efficiently. Ambrose had never fully believed the account, not because he had evidence against it, but because Frederick had been an exceptional rider since the age of 9. And exceptional riders did not simply fall from horses on flat ground in dry weather. He had asked questions once. The right people had given him careful, polished answers, and eventually he had stopped asking, because grief without proof was only madness dressed in mourning clothes. Now he was holding proof, or at least he was holding the claim of proof, written by a woman currently sinking into the Atlantic. He turned to the first mate standing 3 feet behind him, a thick-necked man named Grover who had been assigned to escort Ambrose during his inspection of the vessel and had spent the entire evening looking deeply uncomfortable. "How long ago did they put her in that boat?" Ambrose said. Grover shifted his weight. "Your Grace, the woman was a stowaway. The captain had every legal right to..." "I did not ask for a legal opinion, Grover. I asked how long ago." "Perhaps 4 minutes, Your Grace." Ambrose walked to the rail and looked out. The small boat was still visible, riding the top of a wave before dropping again into the dark water below. She was alive and moving. The boat was not yet swamped. He looked at the davit ropes still hanging over the side where the small boat had been lowered. "Send a crew after her," he said. Grover stared at him. "Your Grace, the captain will not..." "The captain," Ambrose said, turning to face him with the precise quietness that had always been more effective than shouting, "is currently standing on a vessel that I have the authority to detain, search, and report to the Admiralty before sunrise. You may tell him that I would like the woman retrieved, or you may tell him nothing at all and allow me to find someone with actual initiative." Grover left at speed. Ambrose looked back at the water. He was aware that this decision was not without consequences. The man described in the letter, the man who had given the order that killed Frederick, had enough power to arrange a drowning at sea and walk away without a mark against his name. Pulling Beatrix Lorne out of that water would announce to whoever was watching that the letter had been found and that Ambrose intended to act on it. He picked up the letter again and read the closing lines. "I do not ask you to believe me immediately. I only ask that you let me speak before you decide. I have names. I have dates. I have a piece of evidence that was removed from your brother's coat the night he died, and I have kept it hidden for 3 years in a place no one has thought to look. If I am dead by the time this reaches you, then the evidence is hidden beneath the third loose stone from the left in the garden wall of Hartley Cottage, Dorset. Find it before they do. The name of the cottage meant something to him. Hartley Cottage had belonged to his mother before she died. It was a small property, unremarkable, largely forgotten by the family. Frederick had used it occasionally during the summers of his youth. Ambrose had not visited in over a decade. He folded the letter and placed it inside his coat. Behind him, he could hear Grover shouting orders and the sound of ropes being thrown over the side. He did not turn around. He stood at the rail and waited, listening to the water, thinking about Frederick, and thinking about a woman who had pressed a letter between two barrels in the dark because she understood that her life was already over, and the only thing left worth doing was making sure the truth survived her. That, Ambrose thought, was either extraordinary courage or extraordinary desperation. He suspected it was both. They pulled Beatrix Lorne from the sea 20 minutes later. She was not unconscious, which surprised everyone, including Ambrose. She was rigid with cold, her dress was torn across one shoulder, and there was a cut above her left eyebrow that had bled freely down the side of her face. But her eyes were open and focused when they lifted her over the rail and set her on the deck. Her first words, directed at no one in particular, were entirely unexpected. "Did the letter reach him?" Not a question. A statement delivered with the flat urgency of someone who had spent 20 minutes in freezing water thinking of nothing else. "It reached him," Ambrose said, stepping forward. Beatrix looked up at him. She took in his coat, his bearing, the quality of everything about him, and something in her expression shifted. Not relief, exactly. "You are the Duke of Wycliffe," she said. I am. Then you read it. Every word. She closed her eyes briefly. When she opened them again, she sat straighter despite the shivering. Then you know that the moment anyone on this ship reports to the man who ordered this, my life is worth less than the rope they use to tie my wrists. I need to be off this vessel before it reaches port. Ambrose looked at her for a moment. Most women he knew, even the formidable ones, would have been weeping after what she had just survived. Beatrix Lorne was making tactical assessments. "Who is the man your uncle answers to?" he said quietly, crouching to her level so that the conversation did not carry across the deck. Her jaw tightened. "His name is Sir Rowan Callister. He sits on the Board of Trade, holds 3 parliamentary seats through proxies, and has enough connections in the Admiralty that a report filed against him tonight would be buried before morning. He is also the man who was standing in the east field of your brother's estate the night Frederick Harrowby died." Ambrose was still for a moment. "You saw him there?" "I was at Hartley Cottage that night. I had gone to return a book to your brother, which sounds absurd now, but Frederick had lent it to my father weeks before, and my father had just died, and I was returning his belongings to the people they belonged to, because it was the only thing I could think to do with my grief." She paused, and the first crack in her composure appeared, a brief tightening around her eyes that she controlled quickly. "I cut through the east field because it was faster. I heard voices. I stopped because something in the tone of them told me not to move. I saw Sir Rowan Callister standing over your brother, and I saw the 2 men with him, and I understood what I was looking at before I had the words for it." "And the evidence you mentioned in the letter," Ambrose said. "Your brother tore a button from Callister's coat during the struggle. I found it in the grass afterward, when I went to see if Frederick was still alive." Her voice did not waver on that last part, but it cost her something. "He was not. I took the button because I did not know what else to do. I was 19 years old, alone, and I had just watched a powerful man arrange the death of someone I respected. I ran. And Callister knew you had seen him. Not immediately. He discovered it 6 months later, when I made the mistake of confiding in someone I should not have trusted. Since then, I have moved 4 times, changed my name 2 times, and lost every person who tried to help me." She met his eyes directly. "Your brother was a good man, Your Grace. He did not deserve what happened to him. I have carried the weight of knowing the truth and being unable to speak it for 3 years, and I am exhausted by it. If you choose not to believe me, I understand. But I am asking you not to send me back to port on this ship." Ambrose stood. Around them, the crew was pretending not to listen. Grover hovered near the mast, watching Ambrose. Near the captain's door, a figure moved in the shadow. Ambrose clocked it without turning his head. The man Beatrix had called her uncle, the one whose seal had authorized her disposal, was still on this ship. Still watching. "Grover," Ambrose said, in the same tone he might use to request a cup of tea. "Your Grace, Miss Lorne will be transferred to my private cabin for the remainder of the voyage. She is to be treated as a guest under my protection. Anyone who enters that cabin without my direct instruction will answer to me personally, and I promise you that answering to me personally is an experience no man on this vessel wants to have tonight." Grover nodded with the speed of someone who had made a decision about which authority to fear more. Beatrix rose from the deck without assistance, which Ambrose suspected was important to her. She was still shaking from the cold, her hair was plastered flat against her neck, and the cut above her eye had opened again. But she walked with her spine straight and her chin level, and she did not look at the shadowed figure near the captain's door as she passed him. Ambrose did look at him. The man was perhaps 60 years old, silver-haired, with the soft hands and polished coat of someone who had spent his life giving orders rather than following them. He looked at Ambrose's for precisely 2 seconds before looking away. That, Ambrose thought, was all the confirmation he needed. He followed Beatrix below deck, and as he walked, he was already calculating. Callister had connections in the Admiralty, which meant the official route was compromised. He had parliamentary proxies, which meant the legal route would be slow and visible. He had already proved that he was willing to arrange a murder at sea and leave no evidence behind, which meant that the moment he learned Beatrix was alive and under Ambrose's protection, the threat would shift from her alone to both of them. The button from Frederick's coat was hidden beneath the third loose stone from the left in the garden wall of Hartley Cottage. Ambrose needed to reach Dorset before Callister did. He needed to get Beatrix safely off this ship, across the coast, and to that cottage without anyone reporting their movements to the wrong people. And he needed to do all of this while managing the fact that he was now travelling alone with an unmarried woman of no title in situations that would destroy her reputation entirely if they became known, which in Regency England was a problem nearly as serious as the murder itself. He knocked twice on the cabin door, heard her tell him to enter, and stepped inside. Beatrix was seated at the small writing desk, pressing a folded cloth against the cut above her eye with one hand and attempting to wring the water from her sleeve with the other. She looked up when he entered, and for just a moment, before she assembled her composure again, he saw how frightened she actually was. He crossed to the small chest near the bunk, found a dry blanket, and placed it on the desk beside her without comment. She looked at it, then at him. "We reach port at dawn," Ambrose said. "I am going to need you to trust me for the next 6 hours. Not because I have earned it, simply because neither of us has a better option." Beatrix picked up the blanket. "I trusted my uncle," she said. "I trusted the friend I confided in. I trusted the solicitor my father appointed." She wrapped the blanket around her shoulders with the deliberate care of someone performing a small act of self-preservation. "I am not naturally inclined toward trust at the moment, Your Grace." "That is a fair position," Ambrose said. "But I will cooperate," she added, "because you are right. There is no better option." Outside, the sea was beginning to settle. The worst of the storm had passed, and in 4 hours the sky would begin to lighten over the English coast. Somewhere in Dorset, beneath a stone in an old garden wall, a coat button was waiting to bring down one of the most powerful men in England, and in London, Sir Rowan Callister was almost certainly already receiving word that something had gone wrong. They left the ship before the crew had finished docking. Ambrose had arranged it with the kind of quiet efficiency that came from years of moving through difficult situations without drawing attention. A hired carriage was waiting at the eastern end of the harbour, away from the main dock where port officials and early morning merchants would already be gathering. Beatrix was wrapped in a plain travelling cloak borrowed from the captain's wife, her cut eye covered by the hood, and she walked beside Ambrose with the measured pace of someone who had learned that running attracted more attention than calm. Behind them, on the ship, her uncle was being detained. Ambrose had arranged that too, with 3 quiet words to a customs officer he trusted, citing irregularities in the vessel's cargo manifest. It would not hold the man for long, 24 hours at most before someone with the right connections intervened. But 24 hours was enough. The carriage moved fast once they cleared the harbour town, taking the coastal road south toward Dorset with the kind of speed that jolted every bone and made conversation nearly impossible. Beatrix held the door handle and said nothing for the first hour, watching the grey morning countryside move past the window with eyes that were alert but exhausted. Ambrose watched her carefully. She was not what he had expected. He was not entirely sure what he had expected, but it was not this. Not someone who had survived the night she had survived, and was already, he could see it in the set of her jaw, planning her next move. "Tell me about Callister," he said, when the road smoothed enough to allow speech. Beatrix turned from the window. "What specifically?" "His connection to my brother. Frederick was not a political man. He had no parliamentary ambitions. He managed the eastern estates and kept largely to the country. What did he know that made him worth killing?" She was quiet for a moment, not hesitating, gathering. "Your brother discovered that Callister had been diverting funds from 3 separate trade agreements between England and the West Indies, the kind of diversion that, if exposed, would have ended not just Callister's career, but the careers of 7 other men whose names are attached to those agreements, men with titles, men with influence, men who would lose everything." She paused. "Frederick found the original ledgers, the real ones, not the copies presented to Parliament. He sent a letter to Callister, giving him the opportunity to step down quietly rather than face exposure. He believed that was the honorable approach." Ambrose closed his eyes briefly. "Frederick always believed in the honorable approach. Callister responded by inviting him to a private meeting at the estate to discuss terms. There were no terms. There were 2 men waiting in the east field, and there was no horse involved at all." Her voice was flat and precise, delivering facts because facts were what was needed. But Ambrose could hear the edge beneath them. "The horse was found and released afterward to make the scene convincing." Ambrose said nothing for a long moment. Outside, the coastline appeared between gaps in the hedgerows, a pale strip of sea beneath a heavy sky. Frederick had loved this coastline. He had walked it every summer without fail, coming back from it with color in his face and mud on his boots, and the particular contentment of a man who felt most himself in the open air. "The 7 men," Ambrose said. "Do you know their names?" "4 of them. The other 3 I only have partial information on." She reached into the inner lining of the borrowed cloak and produced a folded piece of paper. "I have been carrying this list for 2 years. Every name I could confirm. Every date I could attach to an event. It is not complete, but it is enough." Ambrose took the paper and read it. 2 of the names hit him like cold water. The first was Lord Petworth, who had attended Frederick's funeral and wept openly, and who sat across from Ambrose at dinner 3 times a year. The second was Admiral Gresham, who commanded the Southern Naval District, and who had, Ambrose now recalled with sharp clarity, personally recommended the coroner who had signed Frederick's death report without asking a single question. He folded the paper and placed it inside his coat beside the letter. "You have been carrying this alone," he said. "There was no one else to carry it." The carriage hit a rut in the road and lurched sideways. Beatrix caught herself against the door with practiced ease, as though being thrown around in carriages was simply part of her life now. It probably was, Ambrose thought. They rode in silence after that, but it was not an uncomfortable silence. It was the silence of 2 people who had each been given a great deal to think about and were thinking about it seriously. They were perhaps 4 miles from Hartley Cottage when the second carriage appeared. It came from a side road, moving fast, and pulled directly across the main road ahead of them, blocking passage entirely. Ambrose's driver pulled the horses up hard. Beatrix was thrown forward and caught the seat edge with both hands. Ambrose was already reaching for the door. "Stay inside," he said. "Absolutely not," she replied, and followed him out. 3 men stood in the road. They were not dressed as highwaymen. They were dressed as gentlemen, which was somehow worse. The one in the center was younger than Ambrose had expected, perhaps 30, with a narrow face and the particular cold composure of someone who had done this kind of work before and found it unremarkable. "Your Grace," the man said pleasantly. "Sir Rowan sends his regards. He asks that you return the woman and the letter and continue on your journey without any further involvement in matters that do not concern your house." "My brother's murder," Ambrose said, "concerns my house." The pleasant expression did not change. "There was no murder, Your Grace. There was a tragic accident, which was thoroughly investigated and officially recorded. Sir Rowan would hate for any misunderstanding to damage the reputation of such a distinguished family." "That," Ambrose said, "is a threat." "It is a courtesy," the man said. "The next communication will not be." Behind Ambrose, he heard Beatrix make a small, sharp sound. He turned just in time to see a fourth man, who had come from the ditch on the left side of the road, seize her arm and pull her backward. Ambrose moved without thinking. He crossed the distance in four strides, took the fourth man's wrist with both hands, and applied the specific pressure that a very bored fencing instructor had taught him at 17, and the man released Beatrix with a sound that was not dignified. Ambrose stepped between her and the ditch, and when the narrow-faced man from the road advanced, Ambrose's driver, a former soldier named Potts, who had served in three campaigns and retired to carriage driving specifically because it was supposed to be peaceful, descended from the box with a composure that made all three roadmen recalculate. The standoff lasted approximately 30 seconds. Then the narrow-faced man straightened his coat, looked at Ambrose with an expression that communicated very clearly that this was not finished, and gestured his men back to their carriage. "Sir Rowan will be disappointed," he said. "Sir Rowan," Ambrose replied, "will be in prison before the season ends." The carriage moved off the road. Potts returned to the box. Beatrix stood in the road with her hood pushed back and her hair loose and the cut above her eye bleeding again from the struggle, and she looked at Ambrose with an expression he could not entirely read. "You could have simply handed me over," she said. "It would have been far less complicated for you." "Yes," Ambrose agreed. "It would have." She studied him for a moment. Then she pulled her hood back up and walked to the carriage, and Ambrose followed, and neither of them discussed what had just happened or what it meant. But the attack confirmed two things with absolute clarity. Callister had known they were on that road. Someone on the ship, or at the harbour, had sent word ahead. And Callister was not waiting for negotiation. He was moving to eliminate the problem immediately. Hartley Cottage was smaller than Ambrose remembered. He had visited twice as a child, trailing behind his mother through a garden that had seemed enormous then, and now revealed itself to be modest, slightly overgrown, and entirely silent. The cottage itself was stone-built, two stories with dark windows and a front door that no one had painted in several years. It looked like a place that had been waiting for something without knowing what. Beatrix was out of the carriage before it fully stopped. She went straight to the garden wall, moving with the certainty of someone who had memorized this moment precisely, and counting stones from the left with her fingers rather than her eyes. Third stone. She pressed it. It shifted. Her hand went into the gap beneath and emerged with a small cloth package, wrapped tightly and tied with a length of cord. She stood there holding it for a moment without moving, and Ambrose said nothing, understanding without being told that this was not a moment for words. Then she held it out to him. He unwrapped it carefully. Inside the cloth was a single brass button, slightly tarnished, engraved with a crest that he recognized immediately because he had seen it on a coat hanging in a particular hallway at a particular London dinner not 8 months ago. Beneath the button was a folded note in Frederick's handwriting, brief and dated 2 days before his death. "If anything happens to me, this button belongs to the coat of Sir Rowan Callister." I removed it from his person during an altercation on the 14th. He knows I have it. R.C. is not acting alone. Ambrose read it twice. Then he folded it and placed it with the letter in his coat. "We need to move," Beatrix said quietly. "They know the cottage." "How do you know that?" She pointed to the far end of the garden wall. The stones there were disturbed recently by the look of the turned soil around the base. Someone had searched the wall. Not the right section, but close enough to confirm that Callister's people had been here and had been looking. Ambrose looked at the cottage windows again. The one on the upper left had a different quality of dark than the others. "Back to the carriage," he said, keeping his voice level. "Now." They made it 3 steps before the front door of the cottage opened. The man who stepped out was not one of Callister's road agents. He was older, perhaps 55, with a physician's coat and the steady, unhurried movement of someone who was not here by accident and was not afraid of being found. He stopped on the front step and looked at them both with an expression that was peculiar in its specific quality. He looked relieved. "Your Grace," the man said. "My name is Dr. Harlan Foss. I have been waiting here for 11 days. I was beginning to think no one was coming." Ambrose studied him. "You know who I am. I knew your brother. Frederick sent me here to wait in the event that something happened to him, and the truth needed to reach someone it could trust." He looked at Beatrix. "Miss Lorne, you are alive. I am very glad." Beatrix stared at him. "Frederick told you about me. He told me everything. He was more prepared for the possibility of his own death than any of us wanted to admit." Foss stepped aside from the door. "Please come in. What I have to show you cannot be said on an open doorstep." Inside, the cottage was cold but not abandoned. Someone had kept it in a basic state of use. There was a fire laid but unlit in the sitting room hearth, a table with papers arranged on it, and 2 oil lamps burning low on the mantelpiece. On the table were documents. Not letters, not personal notes, ledgers. 5 of them, the kind used for trade accounts, with columns of figures and notations and names running down the margins in the careful hand of someone who had spent a long time compiling evidence rather than simply recording transactions. "The original ledgers," Beatrix said. She was across the room before Ambrose had taken 3 steps. "Frederick told me he had sent them somewhere safe. I never knew where. He brought them here himself, 3 weeks before he died. He made copies first and sent those to a solicitor in Edinburgh who does not know Callister and has no connections to London society. The originals are here." Foss stood at the table's edge. "These ledgers document 11 years of financial diversion across 4 trade agreements. The figures involved are larger than I can fully comprehend. What I can comprehend is that the names in the margins represent enough of Parliament to make a formal prosecution extremely difficult without the right preparation." "Gresham," Ambrose said, without looking up from the nearest ledger. "On page 43. Petworth. Page 61 and again on 89. Ambrose turned pages slowly. Each one was a door opening onto a room he had not known existed. A room full of men he had shaken hands with and sat across dinner tables from, and trusted in the particular unconscious way that people trusted those who moved in the same circles. Frederick had known and had gathered all of this, methodically and alone, and had brought it here, and had then gone to give Callister the opportunity to step down with dignity. The fury that moved through Ambrose at that thought was very quiet and very complete. There is one more thing, Foss said. He crossed to the fireplace and reached up into the chimney and produced a small sealed envelope from a ledge inside the flue. Frederick left this specifically for you, Your Grace. He said you would come eventually. He said you were stubborn enough that you would never fully stop looking. Ambrose took the envelope. His name was on the front in Frederick's handwriting. Just his name. Ambrose. No title. The way Frederick had written it their entire lives, in notes passed under doors as boys, in letters sent from school, in the margins of books lent back and forth across years of shared shelves. He did not open it immediately. He held it and stood very still for a moment, and the room was quiet around him, and Beatrix, who had been watching him from the other side of the table, looked away and gave him the small private gift of not being observed. When he opened it, the letter inside was one page. Frederick's voice was in every line, easy and warm and direct, and entirely without self-pity, even knowing what he had known when he wrote it. He described what he had found. He described who was involved. He gave Ambrose specific instructions for the solicitor in Edinburgh, and the exact procedure for presenting the ledgers to a judge who was not connected to London society, a man named Crow in the Northern Circuit, who had spent 30 years being specifically unbuyable. The last paragraph was not about evidence or strategy. I know you will feel that you should have protected me. That is the most useless thing you could do with this. I made my own choices, and I do not regret them. What I want is for you to finish it. Not for my sake. For the sake of every person Callister will do this to again, if no one stops him. You are better at this than you think, Ambrose. You always were. Outside, from the direction of the road, came the sound of hooves. More than one horse, moving fast. Potts appeared in the cottage doorway with the expression of a man delivering bad news efficiently. 4 riders, Your Grace, coming from the north road. They are not stopping to ask permission. Ambrose folded Frederick's letter and placed it inside his coat with the others. Foss, he said. Is there a way out of this cottage at the back? Through the kitchen and across the lower field. There is a gap in the hedgerow at the far end that leads to the cliff path. Take the ledgers. All 5. Leave nothing on that table. He looked at Beatrix. Can you run? She had already picked up 2 of the ledgers. I have been running for 3 years, she said. I am very good at it. They went through the kitchen at speed, Foss tucking ledgers under each arm with the focused urgency of a man who understood exactly what was at stake, Potts pulling the kitchen door shut behind them and falling into step at the rear with his hand on something inside his coat that Ambrose chose not to examine too closely. The lower field was wet and uneven, and the sky above it was the particular dense grey of a morning that had decided not to clear. Behind the cottage, they could hear the riders reaching the front gate. Beatrix ran beside Ambrose without stumbling once. And somewhere in London, Sir Rowan Callister was waiting for a report that everything had been handled cleanly. He was going to be deeply disappointed. The cliff path was no wider than a single person. It ran along the edge of the Dorset coastline with the casual indifference of a route that had been worn into the earth by fishermen and smugglers who did not particularly care about safety, dropping sharply on the right side to rocks and water 40 feet below, and pressing against a dense thorn hedgerow on the left that tore at clothing and offered no comfort whatsoever. Ambrose went first. Beatrix followed directly behind him, one ledger pressed against her chest with both arms. Foss came after her, moving with surprising speed for a man his age, his coat pockets bulging with loose papers he had swept from the table at the last moment. Potts came last, walking backward for the first 100 yards, watching the gap in the hedgerow behind them, with the focused attention of a man expecting company. The company arrived sooner than any of them wanted. Two of Callister's riders had gone around the cottage rather than through it, anticipating exactly the retreat that had been made. They appeared at the hedgerow gap on horseback, which was immediately a problem, because horses on a cliff path 40 feet above the sea were not a manageable situation for anyone involved, and both riders seemed to understand this at the same moment they appeared, pulling their animals up hard and dismounting with the speed of men switching strategies. "Move," Ambrose said, and they moved. The path curved left ahead, cutting away from the cliff edge and dropping into a shallow depression between two outcroppings of rock. Ambrose knew this stretch of coast in the vague geographic memory of someone who had walked it as a boy, and what he remembered, surfacing now with sudden usefulness, was that the depression led to a set of stone steps cut into the cliff face, descending to a narrow beach that was accessible only at low tide. "The steps," he said to Foss. Foss looked at him with an expression that communicated several thoughts simultaneously, the primary one being that he was a physician in his 50s and not a coastal adventurer, but he nodded and kept moving. The steps were there. They were also considerably more deteriorated than Ambrose's boyhood memory had suggested, with two completely missing and a third that shifted alarmingly underfoot. But the four of them descended to the narrow strip of grey sand below, with nothing worse than scraped palms, and one moment where Foss grabbed Beatrix's arm, and she grabbed the rock face, and the ledger she was carrying nearly went into the water, and did not, which everyone treated as a significant victory. Behind and above them, at the top of the steps, a man appeared, and then stopped, clearly unwilling to follow. Ambrose looked up at him from the beach. The man looked down, assessed the steps, assessed the drop, and made a sensible decision. "They will go back for horses," Potts said, scanning the beach in both directions with professional efficiency. "There is a path down to this beach from the western end. 20 minutes, perhaps less." "Then we have 20 minutes, Ambrose said. Beatrix set the ledger down on a dry rock and sat beside it, pressing her hands flat against her knees. She was breathing hard from the run, but her color was steady, and her eyes were already moving across the beach, calculating. Ambrose watched her do it and recognized the process, because it was the same one running in his own mind. "There is a fishing village," she said, "half a mile east along this beach. I stayed there for 2 weeks in the autumn 2 years ago, when I was moving along the coast. A man named Briggs keeps 2 boats. He is not connected to anyone in London society, and he does not ask questions." Everyone looked at her. "I told you," she said. 3 years. I know this coastline better than most fishermen." Foss let out a breath that was almost a laugh. "Frederick said you were resourceful. He said it as a compliment." Beatrix went very still. "He spoke about me," she said. "Often." Foss picked up his ledgers and settled them under his arm again. "He said that the young woman who had returned his book in the middle of her grief, with perfect manners and a completely broken heart that she refused to show anyone, was the bravest person he had met that year." Something moved across Beatrix's face, and she controlled it. Ambrose looked away and gave her the same courtesy she had given him in the cottage. They moved east. The beach was a wet shingle that shifted underfoot and made every step slower than it should have been, and the wind off the water was cold enough to make conversation an effort, so they walked in focused silence with the ledgers distributed between them. The village appeared around a curve in the cliff, a cluster of stone buildings above a small harbour with 2 boats pulled up on the shingle exactly where Beatrix had said they would be. Briggs was a broad, weathered man of perhaps 60, who came out of his cottage at the sound of footsteps on the beach and looked at the four of them, one in a duke's coat, one in a borrowed cloak with a cut above her eye, one elderly physician clutching ledgers, and one large former soldier with the unreadable expression of someone who had seen stranger things wash up on this beach and had learned not to comment. "I need passage east," Ambrose said, "as long as your boat will carry us without stopping." Briggs looked at Beatrix. Beatrix met his eyes and gave a small nod. Briggs looked back at Ambrose and named a price that was approximately 4 times what the journey was worth. Ambrose paid it without negotiating. 15 minutes later, they were on the water, moving east along the coastline with the wind behind them and the grey Dorset cliffs receding behind the boat's wake. Pott sat at the bow, watching the cliff top with steady eyes. Foss arranged the ledgers in his lap with the careful attention of a man sorting the most important documents he had ever held. Beatrix sat at the stern with her hood down and her face turned toward the open water, and her expression finally, for the first time since Ambrose had pulled her from the sea, entirely unguarded. He sat beside her. After a long moment, she said, "I used to think that if I could just get the evidence to the right person, it would be over. That truth, if it reached somewhere it could not be ignored, would simply resolve everything neatly." She paused. "It is considerably more complicated than that." "It always is," Ambrose said. "Your brother believed it would be simple. Find the evidence, present it to someone trustworthy, allow the system to function as it was designed to." She was quiet for a moment. He was not naive. He simply had more faith in the structure of things than the structure deserved. "Frederick was always like that," Ambrose said. "He believed people were essentially trying to do right and simply sometimes failed. I always believed people were essentially doing whatever served them and occasionally happened to do right by accident." He paused. "We argued about it frequently. Who was correct?" Ambrose looked out at the water. "I am beginning to think neither of us was." Something shifted between them at that. Neither of them mentioned it. But it was there. From the bow, Pott said quietly, "Company." A second boat had appeared from a cove in the cliff face ahead, small and fast, angling towards them across the water with deliberate intent. 2 men aboard, moving with the coordinated purpose of people who had been waiting. Beatrix stood up in the boat with a balance that made Briggs visibly nervous. "They cut around by road," she said. "They knew the village. They knew about Briggs." Her voice was tight. "Someone told them, someone who knew my history on this coast." She turned to look at Foss. Foss met her gaze steadily. "Do not look at me like that, Miss Lorne. You were in that cottage for 11 days. Alone, in hiding. I spoke to no one." "Then how?" she said. The approaching boat was 40 yards away now. Ambrose could see the men clearly. One of them was the narrow-faced man from the road. He had exchanged his gentleman's coat for something more practical, and his pleasant expression for something that had never been pleasant at all. And in the stern of the boat, directing it with a walking stick pointed like a commander's baton, was a man Ambrose had not expected. Lord Petworth. Not Callister. Not a hired agent. Lord Petworth himself, red-faced and furious. "He is here himself," Ambrose said. "He must be panicking," Beatrix said. "Panicking men do things that careful men do not," Pott said, which was not comforting. Petworth's boat drew alongside with a hard knock against the hull. The narrow-faced man threw a rope over Briggs's rail before anyone could stop him, and pulled the two boats together with the practiced efficiency of someone who had prepared for exactly this. Petworth stood in his boat and looked across at Ambrose with an expression that contained fear and fury in equal and ugly measure. "Harrowby," he said, "this ends here. Give me the ledgers and the letter, and I will guarantee your safety personally. You have my word as a peer. Your word as a peer, Ambrose said, is currently worth considerably less than it was this morning. You do not understand what you are carrying. Those ledgers represent agreements that have kept 3 colonial trade routes stable for a decade. The moment they become public, the economic consequences will... My brother is dead, Ambrose said. Petworth stopped. My brother gathered those ledgers and came to you and Callister in good faith, and you had him killed in a field and dressed it as an accident, and then spent 3 years threatening the only witness into silence. Ambrose's voice had not risen at any point. It was the same even, unhurried tone he had used all morning, which somehow made it worse. Do not speak to me about economic consequences. Petworth looked at Beatrix. Something in his expression shifted, and it was not remorse. It was calculation, the specific reassessment of a man looking at a problem and deciding to change his approach. Take the girl, he said. Everything happened at once. The narrow-faced man vaulted the rail. Potts moved to intercept him, and the two of them collided with an impact that rocked both boats and sent spray across everyone on the deck. Briggs seized a boat hook from somewhere with the resigned competence of a man who had not wanted any of this, but was not about to watch his boat get destroyed without participating. Foss pressed himself against the mast with both arms wrapped around the ledgers, and the expression of a man who had made a decision about what he was protecting. The narrow-faced man was fast and trained, and had the advantage of having initiated the move. But Beatrix Lorne had been outrunning, outwitting, and outlasting dangerous men for 3 years on her own, and she was not standing still. She seized the rope the narrow-faced man had used to tie the boats together, freed it from the rail with 2 fast movements, and shoved Petworth's boat away from theirs with a force that separated the hulls by 6 feet before anyone in that boat understood what she had done. The narrow-faced man was now on the wrong boat. He turned and looked at the gap of open water between him and Petworth with an expression of pure professional irritation. Petworth looked at Beatrix across the water. Beatrix looked back at him without flinching. "Row," Ambrose said to Briggs. Briggs rowed. They reached the eastern port town of Axwell before midday. It was not a large town, not fashionable, not the kind of place that attracted attention from London society or the men who moved through it, which was precisely why it served their purpose. Ambrose sent Potts ahead on foot to arrange horses and a secured room at the posting inn at the top of the Market Street, a plain establishment that asked no questions of guests who paid in advance. Foss laid the 5 ledgers on the inn table and stood back from them, with the exhausted satisfaction of a man who had carried something heavy for a very long time and had finally set it down somewhere solid. Edinburgh, Ambrose said. Tonight, Foss agreed. The solicitor's name is Mr. Graves. He has been holding the copied ledgers for 8 months, waiting for instruction. Between the originals and his copies, and the letter, and Frederick's note, and the button, the case is complete. He paused. Judge Crowe in the Northern Circuit is known to me personally. I can write ahead. Do it now, Ambrose said. Foss settled at the table and began writing with the focused energy of a man who had waited 11 days in a cold cottage for exactly this moment. Beatrix stood at the window, looking down at the Market Street below, with her arms folded across her chest. She had changed into dry clothing, arranged by the innkeeper's wife, a plain, sensible arrangement that suited her far better than the borrowed cloak, and the cut above her eye had been properly cleaned and dressed by Foss, who had done it with the brisk competence of a man for whom minor field medicine was unremarkable. Ambrose stood beside her at the window. It is not finished, she said. No. Callister will know by now that Petworth failed. He will not send agents next time. She turned from the window. He will come himself. He is that kind of man. When everything else fails, he comes himself, and he brings enough force that there is no possibility of another outcome. Her voice was steady, but her hands, where they gripped her own arms, were tight. I have been afraid of that specific event for 3 years. Tell me about him, Ambrose said. Not what he did. Who he is. She looked at him for a moment. Why? Because I need to understand how he thinks. Not what he has done. How he decides. What he considers acceptable risk and what makes him stop. Beatrix was quiet for a long moment. Then she crossed to the table, sat down, and began to speak with the careful precision of someone opening a file they had been keeping organized in their own mind for a very long time. Sir Rowan Callister, she told him, was 63 years old, the second son of a minor baronet from the North Country who had built his entire position through trade connections and political maneuvering across 4 decades. He had no inherited wealth and no inherited title. Everything he had assembled himself, which meant he understood exactly how fragile assembled things were and guarded his position with the specific ferocity of a man who knew what it felt like to have nothing. He was not cruel for pleasure. He was cruel for protection. Every violent act he had sanctioned, including Frederick's death, had been a defensive move, not an aggressive one. He did not attack. He eliminated threats. Which means, Ambrose said slowly, that if the threat changes shape, his response changes. What do you mean? He has been trying to recover the evidence and silence the witnesses because he believes that is the only way to stay safe. But if the evidence were already beyond his reach, if it were already in the hands of someone he could not intimidate or intercept, the calculation changes. He cannot eliminate a case that has already been filed. Beatrix stared at him. You want to move faster than he expects. I want to make his next move pointless before he makes it. She was quiet for a moment, and then something changed in her expression. The Edinburgh solicitor, she said. If Foss can get word to Graves tonight, and Graves files the preliminary documents with Judge Crowe tomorrow, then by the time Callister arrives here, there is nothing left to suppress. The case exists. It is in official hands. Killing us at that point does not save him. It only adds to the charges. Foss looked up from his writing. I can have this letter dispatched within the hour. There is a mail coach north from this town at 2 o'clock. Then it goes on the 2 o'clock. Coach, Ambrose said. It went on the 2 o'clock coach. The afternoon settled into a careful, watchful quiet. Potts positioned himself at the inn's ground floor entrance with the patient immovability of a large piece of furniture that happened to be armed. Foss continued writing, producing a document that was part legal summary and part personal testimony, covering everything he had witnessed and everything Frederick had told him with the methodical thoroughness of a man trained to observe and record. Ambrose sat across the table from Beatrix, and they went through the ledgers together, page by page, and he asked questions, and she answered them, and she asked questions, and he answered them. She asked him about Frederick, on what he had been like. Ambrose told her about a boy who had given away his own birthday cake to a kitchen maid who had mentioned in passing that she had never tasted anything with sugar in it. About a young man who had spent an entire autumn cataloguing the birds on the eastern estate because no one else had done it, and he thought someone should. About a brother who had written letters that were always 3 times longer than necessary, because he could never decide what to leave out. Beatrix listened without interrupting. When he finished, she said, "He lent me a book of botanical illustrations. That was what I was returning the night everything happened. He had lent it to my father because my father had admired a drawing of a particular fern species in it, and my father had kept it for 6 months because he loved it too much to return it promptly. And after he died, I found it on his desk with a note reminding himself to give it back. She paused. I never did return it, actually. I still have it. Ambrose looked at her. It was the only thing I kept, she said, very quietly, when I left everything else behind. Before he could respond, Potts appeared in the doorway with the clipped efficiency of a man delivering information that required immediate action. Carriage at the end of the street, Your Grace. 4 men inside. They have been there 20 minutes without moving. Ambrose was on his feet. Callister, Beatrix said. It was not a question. They moved to the window together. The carriage was unremarkable. Dark, no visible crest, exactly the kind of vehicle that was designed not to attract attention, and instead attracted it precisely by being too careful about it. As they watched, one of the carriage doors opened, and a figure stepped out. Older, silver-haired. Walking with a cane he clearly did not need, carrying it instead as an accessory of authority, he stood in the market street and looked up at the inn with the deliberate patience of a man who had decided that there was no longer any point in sending other people. Sir Rowan Callister had come himself. Ambrose felt the cold clarity that came to him in moments of decision. He turned to Foss. Is the letter on the coach? Dispatched 40 minutes ago. He turned to Beatrix. She was already looking at him, and what he saw in her face was not fear, not the managed composure she had been maintaining all day, but something clear and determined and entirely ready. It is already done, she said. Whatever he does now, it is already done. Ambrose nodded. Then he walked downstairs, crossed the inn's front room, opened the door, and stepped out into the market street. Callister watched him approach without moving. They stood 6 feet apart in the ordinary afternoon street of an ordinary port town, and the distance between them contained 3 years of a woman's suffering, a brother's death, 11 years of stolen wealth, and a letter that was already travelling north on a mail coach and could not be recalled by any power Callister possessed. It is over, Ambrose said simply. Callister looked at him for a long moment. The calculation was visible in his eyes, running through options, assessing angles, searching for the move that was not there. He was a man who had spent 40 years finding moves. The experience of not finding one was unfamiliar, and it showed. You have destroyed things that cannot be rebuilt, Callister said finally. You destroyed them, Ambrose said. In a field 3 years ago, on a dry night in August. Everything since then has simply been the consequence. Callister said nothing. Behind Ambrose, he was aware of Beatrix standing in the inn doorway, and Potts beside her, and Foss at the window above, and all the weight of everything they had carried from the ship to the sea to the cottage to this unremarkable street was present in that moment, and settled now into something that felt, carefully and cautiously, like ground. Callister looked once more at the inn, then at Ambrose, then at something further away that only he could see. Then he turned and walked back to his carriage, and the carriage moved off down the street, and the afternoon was quiet again. It was not the end. There would be hearings and testimony, and the grinding slow machinery of justice that took months and tested patience and occasionally failed in ways that were infuriating. Petworth would hire lawyers. Callister would attempt every maneuver available to a man with resources and connections, and 40 years of knowing where bodies were buried, both figuratively and, as they now understood, literally. But the letter was on the coach. The ledgers were in Foss's hands. Judge Crowe was expecting them, and the button from Frederick's coat small and tarnished and absolutely damning, was wrapped in cloth inside Ambrose's pocket. That evening, Ambrose found Beatrix in the small sitting room at the back of the inn, alone, with the botanical illustration book open on the table in front of her. She had been carrying it, he now realized, inside the borrowed cloak this entire time. Through the sea, through the cliff path, through the boat, through all of it. She looked up when he entered. "What happens now?" she said. "Now," Ambrose said, sitting across from her. "We finish it properly." She looked at the book, then at him. "And after it is finished." He considered the question with the seriousness it deserved. "I think," he said slowly, "that there is a great deal I do not yet know about you, and a great deal you do not yet know about me, and that both of those things, under different circumstances, would be worth knowing." Beatrix looked at him for a long moment. She smiled. "Different circumstances," she said. "Better ones," he said, "which I intend to arrange." Outside, the evening light was settling over the port town, gold and ordinary, and entirely indifferent to dukes and secrets and women who had survived the sea. The mail coach was already two counties north, carrying everything that needed to reach the people it needed to reach. Frederick's letter was safe in Ambrose's coat. The ledgers were locked in Foss's travelling case. And in the market street below, life moved on as it always did, unhurried and unaware. "Now let me ask you something before you go. Beatrix survived the sea, the road, the cliff, and Callister himself, with nothing but 3 years of hard-earned courage, and one letter she refused to let the water take. But here is what I want to know from you. Do you think a man like Callister, who built everything from nothing and protected it without mercy for 40 years, truly accepted what happened in that street? Or do you think the story was not finished at all? Tell me what you think about this. Drop your answer in the comments below."